to add, and that is that God created matter, because this is an ex materia system that God created out of pre-existing matter that was already there. And then the Christians just said, well, take that off and make it ex nihilo, that God created the matter. And Plato has tremendous insights, and Augustine and Anselm were basically Platonic in their metaphysics, granted this change in Plato's system. Once you understand Plato and understand what they did with it, you can see how Christian Platonism was a very, very popular thing. And it lasted right on through until this day. Our venerable Father Lewis Berry Chafer still has some Christian Platonism in him. Usually it comes through all the way to modern evangelicalism in anthropology, namely that the image of God is only in the spiritual part of man, in his soul, but the image of God does not include the body. Somehow Platonists can never quite get to admit that matter is good. But that's exactly what the Bible says. God created the material universe, and he said it's good. And on the last day, he said it's very good. So with that proviso, there are still Platonists today, Christian Platonists. Most Christians still have a shot of that in them. God is his own goodness. Good is God, and God is good. Absolutely none. Aquinas simply took the truth of Augustine and put it into the terms of Aristotle. The main difference between Aquinas and Augustine, Aquinas thought he was a faithful Augustinian. He quoted Augustine, almost never contradicted Augustine. I mean, you have to search to find a handful of passages anywhere in Aquinas where he says, and I disagree with Augustine on this. He agreed with Augustine on virtually everything. He took Augustine's theology, which to be sure, in Augustine's case, was expressed in Platonic terminology, and Augustine expressed that same theology in Aristotelian terminology. Why? Because that's exactly what a Christian philosopher should do. He should take the truth of Scripture and put it in the terms of his day. And in the 13th century, Aristotle was the popular philosophy. Aristotle was in vogue. The pagans were killing Christians because they knew Aristotle and the Christians didn't. So Thomas Aquinas, with the help of Albert the Great and William Morbecki, who translated Aristotle fresh from Greek into Latin — Aquinas didn't know Greek either, along with Augustine — made fresh translations of Aristotle. Aristotle was the philosophy in vogue. Aquinas took those and reinterpreted Aristotle from a Christian perspective and used the greatest philosopher of that day, Aristotle, to refute the pagans. That's what we ought to do today. We ought to become equipped in the terminology and the philosophy of our day, take that philosophy to refute the very people, the very humanists and pantheists who are using that to perpetrate their view. So the central thesis of Aquinas is he took the truth of Augustine and put it into the terms of Aristotle. So you can't really understand Aquinas well unless you understand a little about Aristotle and why he formulated things in that particular way. All right, anything else on argument number one or any aspect of it? Argument number two from Anselm. Number two, the second argument is from perfection. And the second is like unto the first, a little bit shorter. Some beings are more nearly perfect than others. Things cannot be more nearly perfect unless there is a wholly perfect by which they can be compared and judged to be more or less nearly perfect than it. Therefore, there must be a most perfect being, i.e., God. By definition, if there is a God, he would be the most perfect being. This proves there is a most perfect being. So this proves that there is a God. Now, this is just taking the same thing implied in the first argument and stating it in a little simpler form. Let me give you the major objection to this argument and ask you how you would respond. I thought someone was going to bring it up a moment ago. He came very close to bringing up the major objection. When atheists look at this argument, they say, oh, well, there are shorter and taller people, but that doesn't mean there is a tallest person. There are fatter and skinnier people, but that doesn't mean there is a fattest person. Degrees of difference do not automatically imply that there is a most. The best this argument would prove is something like this. There is a largest book in the world because there are smaller books. Therefore, there must be a larger book. Therefore, there must be a largest book. Somewhere in the world, there must be a largest book. But it doesn't mean that it's the largest book possible. In fact, we know you could always make it bigger. All you'd have to do is add one more page to it. So this argument doesn't really prove there is a most perfect, any more than saying I am taller than Dr. Campbell proves that there is a tallest person in the world. Just proves that a tallest person possible. Just proves that there are taller people and there are fatter people, but there doesn't have to be the fattest possible person or the tallest possible person. What would you say in response to that objection? There are two things that come to mind. What? Exactly. That's one very good answer to it. It is a confusion of categories. All those illustrations were quantitative illustrations, and we are not talking about the quantitative, we're talking about the qualitative. And to assume that the quantitative applies to the qualitative is a category mistake. It's like assuming that blue tastes good and that red tastes bad. Those are different categories. There's another way you can get at the argument. Anybody think of another way? You can get at the argument by bypassing the whole question of more or less. All you have to do is to do what C.S. Lewis did and say, once you say something is imperfect, you forget about whether there are degrees of perfection or not. You're assuming some standard of perfection beyond the world by which you're measuring the world. So forget about whether there are degrees of perfection. Grant the opponent his fondest wish that quantity and quality are in the same category and that his illustration refutes you. And say, if you assume that something is imperfect, you must have a standard of perfection by which you are measuring that. Otherwise, it's not really imperfect. It's just different. But am I willing to say Mother Teresa and Sister Boom Boom are just different? Am I willing to say that helping the poor in their poverty and killing all Jews off are just different acts? The one is not better than the other. So as soon as you say that one is morally good and that you've got a moral standard beyond the world by which you're judging this act in the world, then you've still set up some absolute standard by which you're measuring this relative moral world, some perfect by which you're judging it to be imperfect. Let me tell you a real live story of how this dramatized itself one day in a debate. I was debating an atheist in Chicago in a college, and I used this argument because his whole debate tactic was to say, look at the evil in the world, look at the imperfections, there can't be a God. That was his main argument against God. So I used C.S. Lewis' argument that if you're looking at injustices, you're supposing a standard of justice. And if you think that this is ultimately unjust, there must be an ultimate standard of justice. So are you saying there is an ultimate standard of justice by which you are measuring the world? If so, you're implying God in order to disprove God. Now, his dilemma then was either one, to deny that he had an ultimate standard of justice by which he was saying this is ultimately unjust, or to admit that he didn't have anything that was ultimately unjust, and therefore he couldn't really disprove God. That's the dilemma of that. He chose the latter horn of the dilemma. And his answer, to paraphrase it, virtually quote it, went like this. I do not say there is an ultimate standard of justice by which I measure the world unjust. I believe the world is evil because of my own, quote, benign moral feelings, end quote. Now, what was a surprise to me is that nobody laughed. Suppose that I had come there to debate as a Christian and I had said, I don't really have any reason for believing in God other than my, quote, more benign moral feelings, end quote. Surely everybody would have laughed, wouldn't they? Ha, 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 see, these Christians just experience. What was surprised to me is that nobody laughed when he said that the only basis he had was his own benign moral feelings. He had to admit that you can't move the world unless you have some place to put your fulcrum. If you put your fulcrum in quicksand, it's not going to move the world. If you put it on rock, then you are admitting there is some standard, unmovable standard, by which you're intending to move the world. So he backed off, seems to me, into the wrong alternative. Interesting footnote to that debate. 10 years later, while I was down here a few years ago, I got a letter from a Presbyterian minister saying, incidentally, I never told you, but I attended that first debate and I became a Christian as a result of that debate and went into the ministry and now I'm a Presbyterian minister in such and such a city, which was very interesting to me because I didn't think anybody got saved, let alone was converted as a result of it, but cast your bread upon the water and after many days it will return buttered. Geisler translation of Ecclesiastes. Okay, any question on point two? Third argument of Anselm. An argument from being. This is the most obviously cosmological type argument in Anselm. Something exists, the denial of this is contradictory. You cannot say something does not exist without logically implying that something does exist. Logically impossible, said Anselm, to say something exists, to say nothing exists unless something does exist. Two, whatever exists, exists either through something or through nothing. Either nothing caused this to exist, or something caused it to exist. Three, something cannot exist through nothing, only nothing exists through nothing. Even Julie Andrews knew that. Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could, she sang in The Sound of Music. Four, there is something through which something exists, or this something through which something exists, is either one or many. If many, then they are either mutually dependent or all dependent on one for their existence. Six, they cannot be mutually dependent for their existence, for something cannot exist through a being on which it confers existence. I can't be causing your existence while you're causing my existence. It's impossible. Seven, therefore, there must be one being through which all other beings exist. This one being must exist through itself, since everything else exists through it. Whatever exists through itself exists in the highest degree of all. Now, see, if he were a Thomist, which would be an anachronism because he's living 1,000, Aquinas is living 1,300, but if he were an Aristotelian, he might not have added the next two premises. He's got a good argument going right there. He could have stopped right at point A, but his Platonism leads him to get on to this degree of perfection and add another thing to it. So 9 and 10, whatever else exists through itself exists in the highest degree of all. Therefore, there exists a supremely perfect being that exists in the highest degree of all. All right, let's analyze this argument. First of all, it's cosmological. Secondly, it's, to say the same thing, an argument from effect to cause. Etiological, that's called A-E-T, etiological. Thirdly, it's an argument that begins with existence. It begins with some existing something and goes back to a cause of all existence. Fourthly, it implies the principle of causality, which in its existential form, the form that has to do with existence, is only something can cause something. Every something has something that caused it. You can't have something that was caused by nothing, because nothing can't cause anything. Now let's put the argument in a very simple fundamental form. First premise is something exists, being. Second premise is nothing, non-being, cannot create something. Now before we get to Anselm's completion of this argument, I want to skip over the centuries to modern time, to Jonathan Edwards, red-blooded, five-point Calvinist, hair-curling Calvinist, to be sure. By no means a fideist, Jonathan Edwards gave this same argument for the existence of God, and in the Bibsack lectures of John Gerstner, who is Jonathan Edwards reincarnate in the 20th century. John Gerstner, who gave the lectures here at Dallas about 12 years ago, I'm guessing, his lectures were published in Bibsack, Gerstner's lectures on Jonathan Edwards, and this argument is elaborated in that series, if you want to read something very fascinating on it. When Jonathan Edwards was only a teenager, was still in his teens, he developed this argument for the existence of God. And the argument has only three steps to it, those two and this one. Therefore, there must be an eternal and necessary being. Something exists, nothing cannot cause something, therefore there must be an eternal and necessary something, i.e., God. Now, before we take any questions, I want to show how that conclusion, number three, follows from those two premises and why this is such a powerful argument. First of all, let's subdivide three into 3A and 3B. Why is it that there must be an eternal being? First, and then secondly, why is it that there must be a necessary being? If something exists, and if nothing cannot cause something, then the reason something must always have existed is simply this. If you ever had a state of total nothingness, you would always have a state of total nothingness, for the simple reason that from a state of total nothingness, nothing can ever come, because nothing cannot cause something. So suppose a state of total nothingness, and suppose that nothing can never produce something. Then once you have a state of total nothingness, you will always have a state of total nothingness. That's why if something now exists, which means that you don't have a state of total nothingness, something must always have existed. Got to have eternal being provided that something now exists, and something does exist. I do. And I can't deny my own existence. So he has an undeniable first premise. He has a second premise, the opposite of which is absurd. Nothing caused something. And 3a follows, there must be an eternal existence. Now, we haven't proven it's not the universe. We haven't proven a lot of things. But at least, notice, you've got an eternal being here, which is something. 3b, why is it that you must have a necessary being? Now, that one I'm going to throw out to you and see if you can see why these two premises necessarily leads to a necessary being. Why is it that if something exists and nothing cannot produce something, something must always have existed? Not something may always have existed.
Because we're here
doesn't quite do it. That's just part of the argument. Still need more. Not quite. Remember the old game? You're getting warm. Why? Wait, let him finish. But nobody has yet hit on why must it exist. See, it's got to be a necessary being, not just a being that's a cause, but a necessary being. Why must it be a necessary being? Go ahead. Nope, that's not it either. That's right. Especially when you add the second part. Suppose, you got to think of the opposite. Suppose that it weren't a necessary being. Suppose that we got this eternal being, but it's not necessary. What does not necessary mean? It may not be. But if it may not be, then it's only contingent. Because that's what a contingent being is. A contingent being is a being that may not be. A necessary being is a being that cannot not be. And if it weren't a necessary being, it would be a being that may not be. Now, if it may not be, that means it could not be. But if it could not be, that means you could have a state of total nothingness, but you can't have a state of total nothingness because there's something, and something must be caused by something, so this something that caused it has to be a necessary being. If it weren't a necessary being, it wouldn't be the ground of beings that come to be. Explain another way. If you're a contingent being, you can come to be and cease to be. If you're a necessary being, you cannot come to be and you cannot cease to be, by definition. If everything in the universe were a contingent being that could not be, then it's possible that everything not exist at all. But the very fact that something does exist shows that something must always have existed, and something must necessarily exist as a ground for how it can come to be and cease to be. Because the things that come to be and cease to be could all cease to be. Then what would there be? Nothing, unless there were a necessary being, which was the ground of their coming to be and ceasing to be. So the very fact that things come to be and cease to be proves that there must be always something that never comes to be and never ceases to be as their ground. Another way to say it is, No contingent being can be the cause of another contingent being. Suppose you jump out of an airplane, your chute doesn't open. As tragically happened to the cameraman last year who was taking pictures of other people jumping out of airplanes, and then after he finished taking their pictures, he suddenly discovered that he didn't have a chute. He had jumped out of the airplane without a chute. And of course, he was killed on landing. If you don't have a chute, you're not going to hold up somebody else whose chute hasn't opened. One contingent being can't hold up another contingent being. I can't say to you, hey, you forgot your chute? Hang on to me. And you look at me and say, where's your chute? Chute. It's not going to work, see? Now, it doesn't matter how many people you get. All right, so that's a good question. First of all, you can look at this argument, his question, either horizontally or vertically. If you look at it horizontally, it's just an infinite regress question. You're simply asking, so on the supposition that your parents did cause you to exist, which I'm going to reject in a moment, but on that supposition that your parents caused you to exist and their parents caused them to exist, then you've got to get back to a first cause that caused them to exist, so it's otherwise you have an infinite regress. But your parents were not the cause of your being. They were simply the cause of your becoming. And there's a difference between the cause of being and the cause of becoming. Your parents caused you to come to be, but they didn't cause you to be. Why? Because you be even when your parents die. If they were causing your being, when they die, you die. They're only causing your coming to be, the way the artist causes the painting to come to be, but he doesn't cause the painting to continue to be. He could die immediately after he paints it, and the painting continues to be. What we're talking about here is the cause of the being, not the cause of the becoming of things. We're talking about why things exist. They have to have a cause for their existence. Well, you can't. If you could prove that something could not exist by itself, you just prove that there couldn't be a God. What's wrong about it? Somebody else tell me what's wrong about his very starting premise. That's a typical way of putting it, and that's the way the atheists generally put it, and we're dead in the water if that's right. Because that argument, if put that way, and if his starting premise is right, the atheist is right and we're wrong. But what's wrong with the starting premise? That's one way to put it. Another way, but see, the starting premise is nothing can exist by itself. Everything needs a cause. There are two ways to put it. We don't say that. We simply say every contingent thing needs a cause. Everything that comes to be needs a cause. Once you say everything needs a cause, then so does God. We simply say that everything that comes to be had a cause. God didn't come to be, so God didn't need a cause. And if the atheist says, well, you just posited an uncaused God, and that doesn't explain anything, then you say to him, where did the universe come from? And he'll say, it's always been here. And you say to him, that doesn't explain anything. In other words, he has an uncaused cause in his system too. He can't reject our uncaused cause as meaningless if he accepts matter as eternal. You know, he'll fall back on the first law of thermodynamics and say, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So, okay, then you've got something that wasn't caused, right? Matter is uncaused and eternal? Well, you just told me I couldn't have something that was uncaused and eternal, because that's not meaningful. What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Because if it weren't a necessary being, it too would have to have a cause. But if it is the uncaused cause, obviously it doesn't have a cause. If it's a necessary being, it cannot come to be. If it's a contingent being, it can come to be. Everything that can come to be must ultimately depend on that which cannot come to be and cannot cease to be. Otherwise, there would be no ground for it coming to be. Things could come to be and cease to be on a basis of nothing, but nothing cannot produce something. If nothing cannot produce something, then there must be a necessary being as the cause of things that come to be and cease to be. That's what's so profound about this argument. It's so simple, two premises and a conclusion that proves an eternal and necessary being. To be.
To be, or is everything directly related to the end?
No contingent being can cause another contingent being to be any more than one paratrooper without his parachute can hold up another paratrooper without his parachute. Another way to put it, every contingent being, by its very nature, equals an effect. In other words, it came to be, and whatever comes to be was caused to come to be, and whatever was caused to come to be is an effect. Every contingent being, by its very nature, is an effect. Adding up an infinite number of effects doesn't get you to a cause. It just gives you a big pile of effects. He's got an infinitely long pile of effects. Adding up any number of finite things never gets you to an infinite, because you can always add one more, and you can't have more than an infinite. So no contingent being can cause the being of any other contingent being. He can help the becoming, like a parent can be the cause of the becoming. But really there, the parent is only the instrumental cause that through which you came to be. They're not even the efficient cause. God is even the efficient cause there, if you want to trace it back to the beginning. But God is the cause of your being at all times. Any other question or comment about the argument? Yes.
When you get to the point of saying that matter, or atheist says matter is not one cause, how would you argue that that's not necessary?
How would I argue that matter isn't necessary? Okay, two things on that. That first law, we've bought a bill of goods on that first law of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics does not mean what I just quoted it to mean, because I was deliberately quoting it the way the atheist quotes it. The first law of thermodynamics, you can state it in a philosophical way, which is unprovable, or you can state it in a scientific way. The atheist always states it in a philosophical way. He always says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. He's saying you can't create it and you can't destroy it. Now, is there any way you could observe the truth of that premise? It's not observable, therefore it has no scientific basis. Has no observational, what doesn't have observational basis about it? That it can't be created. There's no way to observe a statement, X cannot be created. That's a philosophical, dogmatic, metaphysical pronouncement. And there's no way to observe a statement, it cannot be destroyed. How do you know scientifically, on the basis of present observation, no matter how many times you repeat it over, that it can't be destroyed? Here's the way it should be stated. The amount of actual energy in the universe remains constant. You can observe that. As far as observation is concerned, there is no observation to contradict that statement. Nobody ever observed the steady state theory, hydrogen atoms spontaneously coming into existence, which would be the opposite of this. Nobody ever observed that. So that's observable. Energy remains constant. But in that formalization of it, it doesn't say it couldn't be created. It doesn't say it wasn't created. It just simply says energy as we have it now, the actual amount, not the usable amount, remains constant. So it doesn't prove or disprove as such the existence of God. You've got to go to the second law of thermodynamics, which says that the usable amount of energy is decreasing. Now, here's how we know that it's not eternal and necessary, which is what your question was. It can't be eternal if it's running down. Otherwise, it would have run down a long time ago. Can't run out of an infinite amount of energy. If you run out of gas, you have a finite gas tank. If you don't ever run out of gas, you have an infinite source somewhere.
What does the atheist or the evolutionary scientist say to that? They have an argument against it.
Oh, they've got all kinds of speculations against it. One of them goes like this. One of them is the rebound theory that... Sure, it's running down, but it's going to rebound back and then run down and rebound back. And to that we reply, doesn't matter whether it's rebounding or not, it's not going to rebound as far the second time you drop a ball. And what happens? Sure, it'll rebound, but it never rebounds exactly as high as it was before. And the third time, it's even a little less, and the next time, and sooner or later, even on a rebound theory, you're going to run out anyway. It just makes it a little longer. You just made the process a little more painful. But if the second law applies, it's not going to rebound as much each time, and sooner or later it's going to collapse and not rebound. That's the best, I mean, that's the final line of defense. They don't even have an explanation of the first line. There is not enough known mass in the universe right now to make it rebound once. There's not enough known mass to make it rebound even the first time. But even if there were, and they discovered more mass to make it rebound, it's still going to peter out sooner or later. Why? Second law says you always lose something every time. Now, if they say it rebounds without ever, ever losing anything, that's magic. That's not science. It's not even good philosophy. What you have is a self-caused universe, self-generating universe, that every time it unwinds, it automatically rewinds itself without any outside energy. But that's contrary to the second law. Second law says you cannot rewind yourself without some outside energy. All right, anything else on...
Is any philosophy or philosopher denying that exists or something exists?
Oh yeah, back to the first premise. I think Anselm, and hear me through, is wrong on his first premise. And I'll tell you why. He says the opposite of something exists is a contradiction. He says it is logically contradictory to say there is no contradiction in the concept of total nothingness. Total nothingness is not a logically contradictory concept. It's not like saying square circle. Total nothingness does not presuppose somethingness. Now, the concept no thing implies the concept something, because you have to have a thing before you can have a no thing. So the concept of nothing presupposes the concept of something, but a state of nothingness does not presuppose a state of somethingness. You could have a state of total nothingness without having presupposed a state of somethingness. If that's so, then it is not contradictory to say nothing ever existed, including God. It is undeniable, but it's not contradictory. So what I would disagree with him on is he is making this a logical contradiction rather than an actually undeniable statement. I cannot open my mouth and say I don't exist unless I exist. That's actually undeniable, but it's not logically contradictory to say Geisler never existed. It's not logically contradictory for me to say it is possible that Geisler never existed. It's not logically impossible that Dallas Seminary never existed. It's not logically impossible all of us in this room never existed. It's actually undeniable, because open your mouth to say I never existed, and you have to exist to say it, which proves that you did exist, at least when you said it. So it's actually undeniable that something exists, but it's not logically contradictory to say nothing ever existed. But other than that fine-tuned point of number one, I think he's got something rolling here that's a good argument. Let's go through the premises again. One is something exists. Two is whatever exists exists either through something or through nothing. Incidentally, that very premise is denied by a lot of modern philosophers and scientists now. Many people believe that David Hume denied that premise. We'll see that that's not the case. David Hume was once quoted in a letter to Stewart saying, "I never ever asserted such an absurd thing as that things arise without a cause." He called that absurd. He did say you don't always know what the cause is, but he never said that something can arise without a cause. So they're wrong about David Hume historically. But Isaac Asimov said that nothing can produce something. Asimov said, in a state of total nothingness, you have two possibilities. Either something could come from it, or nothing could come from it. And these two are about equal possibilities. So something came from it, which was one of the possibilities anyway. And that's how they explain the Big Bang Theory. The scientists who are atheists, who have to admit that if you turn the camera of an expanding universe in reverse, and everything exploded from this point is getting bigger and bigger, farther away, you turn that in reverse, and what happens? It keeps going until it vanishes. And at the vanishing point, that means there's no matter, no time, no space, no nothing. That means nothing. It means the universe came into existence out of nothing. Now, they have to face this evidence. They can't deny it. And what they say is, well, sure, you go back to nothing, but so what? Nothing could either become something or nothing could remain nothing. 50-50 chance, it became something. Now, how do you handle something like that? Well, there's two ways. One is historical. Three ways. One is historical, one is observational, and one is philosophical. Historically, you laugh. Because historically, those very same people, atheists, were the ones who said, you Christians who believe someone created something out of nothing, ex nihilo, that's absurd. Now they're saying nothing created something out of nothing. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, if something couldn't create something out of nothing, if that was absurd, then surely nothing creating something out of nothing is a fortiori absurd. So historically, you laugh. Observationally, you say, that's contrary to our experience. Things don't happen willy-nilly. You know, you never drive down a road that you've been driving down for 10 years where there was a stop sign, and that day you get right up to the, no, to take the stop sign. You drive down a road where there's an intersection but no stop sign, and you're about to go through the intersection where you've gone through many times where there's no stop sign, and popo, right out of nothing came a red light hanging right in the middle of the air that's there. Just never happens. Things don't happen willy-nilly like that. Things in our experience always happen with antecedent conditions. A necessary condition is what we mean, sufficient condition is what we mean by a cause. Things don't happen willy-nilly. So it's contrary to our very experience, which means it's contrary to the whole of modern science, which is built on observation and experience. Thirdly, philosophically, that nothing can produce something is really inherently absurd. And you can see it when you talk about, when you analyze Asimov's statement. Here's what he says. There was more power in nothing, dot, dot, dot. That's his exact phrase. He said, there was more power in this nothingness. And you say, wait, whoa, whoa. I thought it was nothing. I mean, where'd you get this power? Power is something. Where'd you get this power in nothingness? I mean, it's absurd to say that nothing produced something, because the very idea of produced implies a producer. The very idea of effectuated implies an effectuator. So it is absurd, philosophically absurd, to talk about nothing as though it were something. You're giving an ontological status to nothing, where nothing has no ontological status. It's nothing. So I think it's both historically, scientifically, and philosophically absurd to do it, but that doesn't mean it's going to keep people from doing it. There's always someone who's going to do it anyway.
The best argument is that it's philosophically absurd, because of the fact, just the concept of nothing. What some of the guys, like what Richard Feynman says, is that it's extremely unlikely that that red light would appear out of nothing. But in an infinite universe, it has to be possible. And he kind of jokingly says that it's very close to infinitely impossible, but since you have infinity,
It only had to happen once. That's what he says about the universe. You know, yes, it's almost infinitely impossible that it happened. But, you know, it only had to happen once.
But even there, they're assuming that there is something there out of which it can come. They're still giving an ontological status. When they talk about this infinite possibility, there is an ontological status to this infinite potential before it came to being. It's almost like, I don't know if you've read Whitehead, but it's almost like there's a whole world of little eternal objects there, little platonic forms, little qualities or potentials for existence, and out of this infinite potential, this infinite pool that's there, almost an infinite chaos, the equivalent of Plato's matter from a modern scientific standpoint, out of this infinite pool of little entities of some kind, qualitative entities, there was the chance it could organize. So they're talking about a real but disorganized potential. And then what are the chances it could organize? But they're giving ontological status. They've got something there from which the something is coming. It's just something. They're just saying, what are the chances that this something could, that's disorganized, could get into something that's organized? And if that's all they mean, then we can say, well, at least you grant that there's, it takes something to make something, and at least you have to have something disorganized from which you can get something organized. Right now we can talk about the teleological argument. Does disorganization ever produce organization? Does design ever appear without a designer? Does specified complexity, a la Thaxton's argument in The Mystery of Life's Origin, does specified complexity ever come without an intelligent cause? And by the way, I was giving a lecture at Davis, University of Davis, California, where Ayala and a number of well-known evolutionists were there, and I was lecturing in the evolution class, and all the professors came too, on creation, just a couple years ago. And they all came to class, and there was one Christian who had just finished his PhD in physics who came, and he was a creationist, and he brought up an interesting point on this. When some of them were using that very kind of argument, he said, wait a minute, we just had, what's his name, Prigogine, the guy who is into this whole self-organization theory thing. He said, we just had him here not too long ago, and this whole idea of chaos coming into organization and then collapsing again and coming into organization, he said, he told us, and they were all in the room and had heard him, he told us that the chances that disorganization would produce organization is like the chances that a pen, as a result of an explosion, would stand on its point for 100,000 years. Well, there's not much chance that a pen is even going to stand on its point after an explosion. I mean, everyone we ever see there, but if you did find one standing on its point, it's not going to stand there on its point with all of the forces going on in a random universe, which is what that is, for 10,000 years on its point, which was his way of demonstrating the improbability of that type of thing ever occurring. Yeah. Yeah.
He has gone beyond just responding. He now wants to encroach on the Christian spirit and their own.
He's great at writing novels. And his commentary on Genesis is very novel. It is a novel, in fact. It's not doesn't have any resemblance to the real at all, but he does it. Isn't it interesting? Francis Schaeffer pointed this out once. Isn't it interesting that even the most ardent atheists have to deal with revelation? They cannot ignore it. It's there. They've got to handle it. They have to distort it, of course, twist it to their own destruction, but they can't totally ignore it. They got to somehow interact with it.
Element of faith,
the element of faith, Jesus exists in order for a person to believe in the existence of God. Do you think that philosophical arguments as these you are using would be enough to prove?
Well, I think they are in, I don't think it's an either or, I think it's a both and. I think these are enough to prove anyway, regardless of whether or not belief in is necessary as opposed to belief that. But remember that all we said at the beginning of the course is that apologetics deals with belief that. We never said that apologetics in and of itself. That's the Holy Spirit and free will. So this is simply giving an argument that God exists. It's not giving a justification for believing in Him. The justification for believing in God is that He is God. There is no other justification. This is just showing you that there is a God that you can choose to believe in if you want to. By way of introduction, Anselm did not believe this was an ontological proof for God as such. Anselm thought that this was an understanding of the nature of God. As he was meditating on God in prayer one day, this came to him. So he didn't devise it as a basic proof for God, number one. Number two, he had already given his cosmological proofs for the existence of God that we went through last time. So on the basis of the fact that he already believed God exists, that he already had proofs for the existence of God, I think this argument is best understood as a delineation of the nature of the God but it has been, that he already believed and had proofs for. However, it has been understood as a proof, particularly since the time of Kant, who was the first one to call it an ontological proof. Anselm never called it that. Immanuel Kant did. Thirdly, there are two forms of the argument. The first form is generally called Anselm A, and the second form is called Anselm B. In the Anselm A form of the argument, he is talking about the existence of God from the nature of perfection. It's an argument built on the concept of perfection. The second one is built on the concept of necessity. And the second one seemed to kind of flow out in the dialogue with the monk Ganillo, who opposed Anselm and who provided the kind of dialogue on the argument as it unfolded. We'll take them in the order in which Anselm gave them. Number one, Anselm argument on the top of the page. God is by definition that than which nothing greater can be deceived. This definition is understood by both believers and unbelievers. Two, it is one thing to exist in the understanding only, and another thing to exist both in the understanding and outside the understanding. For example, a painting exists only in the painter's mind, as opposed to one both in his mind and on the canvas. Three, it is greater to exist both in the understanding and outside the understanding than in the understanding only. Four, therefore, God must exist both in the understanding and outside the understanding, that is, in reality. If he did not, then we could conceive of one who did, which would be greater. But God, by definition, agreed upon by both believer and unbeliever, is the greatest being conceivable. Hence, God must exist. Now, this is Anselm A, and Anselm A is built on the idea that there must be, that it is possible to conceive of an absolutely perfect being. And you could diagram the argument this way. God, by definition, must have all possible perfections. So this would indicate P, all possible perfections. I mean, if he's God, by definition, he must possess all possible perfections. Existence is one of the possible perfections that God could have. Therefore, God must exist. Because if he didn't exist, you could conceive of something that was greater. But God is, by definition, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. If God is, by definition, that than which nothing greater can be conceived, and you could conceive of a God without existence, then that wouldn't be the greatest that you could conceive. The very fact that you can conceive of something without existence and with existence shows that the one lacks something and the other doesn't. The one lacks the perfection of existence, the other one doesn't lack it. The one that lacks it wouldn't be that than which nothing greater could be conceived, because you could conceive of one that had it. Therefore, God must exist by definition. So beginning by pure definition, God is defined as that than which nothing greater can be conceived. You must conclude that he exists, because if he didn't exist, you could conceive of something greater, namely something that did have existence and all of the rest of the things that he has. So a God conceived of as not existing wouldn't have all perfections. God has all perfections, therefore God must be conceived of as existing. That's Anselm A. Has three simple premises. God, by definition, has all possible perfection. Existence is a perfection, therefore God must exist.
And nominally, it sounds like perfection, it to me would be a dependent quality of non-existence as opposed to the other way around.
Okay, that's getting in the same direction that many of the historic criticisms of the argument have gone, particularly since Kant. When you state the argument that way, 1, 2, 3, it's pretty clear that the difficulty is with the second premise, that God equals, by definition, all perfections. Existence is a perfection, therefore God exists. It's pretty obvious that the problem is going to be with premise number two, if there is a problem with it, because there's no problem with defining God that way. You could define, let's say, a mermaid is, by definition, half woman and half fish. I mean, now you can go around swimming in the oceans to see if you can find one. The first premise is purely definitional. There's no reason why we couldn't define a snipe, for example, that mythical animal sought by teenagers on their evenings to play. You could define one, then go look for it. You can't criticize him for defining God as a being that has all possible perfections, that nothing greater could be conceived, because when you think about it, and that's what he was doing, he was praying and meditating on God. He was saying, look, who is God? Well, he's that than which nothing greater could be conceived. You can't possibly conceive of being greater than God. If you could, that being would be God. And the one you're now thinking of wouldn't be God. If somehow you can think of something greater, then the greatest is God. God is, by definition, that than which nothing greater could be conceived. Existence is a perfection. Is it really? That's the troublesome premise. Is existence a perfection? Matter of fact, Immanuel Kant is later going to challenge this, and most of the modern world will agree with Kant. Kant will say existence is not a perfection. Existence is simply an instance of a perfection, but is not itself a perfection. Translated into English, Kant's objection goes something like this. The dollar bill in my wallet, and that's exactly what I have. I just looked a moment ago, $1 bill in my wallet. The dollar bill in my wallet and the one in my mind have exactly the same characteristics. I'm thinking of a dollar bill, and a dollar bill in my